Today is May 25th, 2016, and this is episode number 361 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO. And this is usually where you hear Brian talk, but I need to let you know, my audio just totally fell apart this week, and it's just became a disaster in my ears. Luckily, I suppose, there were all kinds of other things that kept me from being able to talk very much during this episode, so you won't hear a lot of me, but when you do, I'm kind of echoey, and I'm really sorry about that, because that was just one of those things we couldn't fix. And now that you're prepared, we'll just jump right in and pick up with the rest of the intro. Take it away, Brian.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, and I didn't come up with the title. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
I'm not surprised you didn't have a title. You're very busy.
Yes. And one of the things that makes us busy today is that we have a special guest.
We do. Tell me.
Todd Weaver, founder and CEO of Purism. That would be puri.sm for those keeping score at home. Who we either promised or threatened to have this week on the other show, the TDO show.
That's right. Last Friday, we mentioned that Todd would be on. So I guess it's a matter of perspective, Todd, if we invited you on or forced you on.
Well, I think it might have been both. So if that's possible, it was an invitation, and then also you must be on next Wednesday. So
yes,
I'll say it's both.
True.
Can I answer that as both? Is that possible?
Yes.
But I'm actually really happy to be here. So I'm gonna actually take it as the perception of an invitation alone.
We're very happy to have you here. Now,
yes.
For those who didn't listen to TDO, I met Todd at PepCom in San Francisco last Thursday, and we had a fantastic conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it, about his company Purism, and they don't make Apple related products. In fact, they're in competition with Apple. But their focus, which is privacy and security, is an area of great interest to me and Jeff. We know that it's an area of great interest to our listeners as well. And Todd has some very, very interesting perspectives on this. And I thought that this is just absolutely a conversation we should all be having.
I agree. And Brian, after you told me about Todd's company and what he's doing, I was really interested to get him on the show. So, Todd, I'm glad you're here.
I'm very happy to be here.
So, let's start with what Purism is. And why don't we, because I'm just going to mess it up. Why don't you actually tell us what your company does?
Sure. Well, I'll actually relate a lot of the conversations to Apple, since obviously a lot of your listener base will understand the comparisons. So what we do is we manufacture hardware and we bundle that together with software. It's really designed around protecting your privacy, your security, and your freedom, primarily around making devices and software that does not track you in any way. Be that for corporate surveillance or for state surveillance or even for just encrypting your files so you can keep them just to yourself. So it really is around privacy protection and protecting your digital rights.
Well, let me actually interrupt there, because you introduced me to a concept, to a label, actually. You introduced me to a label for a concept that has been of paramount importance in the Apple world for the last several months, but something that we've talked a lot about at the Mac Observer for years, and that label is surveillance capitalism.
Yes, absolutely.
I love that term.
God, it's so brilliant. It just so encapsulates what we've been seeing From my perspective with Google and Facebook in particular, but really with a wide variety of tech companies who all seek to profit from by making us the product.
Right, and so obviously you've heard the terms of, you know, if you're signing up for something for free, you're the product, and other types of things. But one of the things that I really like about surveillance capitalism is that it in two words describes a greater push towards the majority of corporations that they can exploit their users for their gain, and in some cases, right. So when you're talking about Google and Facebook, then it's very easy because you can track the money and obviously know that they are the poster child for surveillance capitalism. And then if you look towards other companies, so this is where Apple or Microsoft and others, that they aren't sharing that data with third parties in a lot of cases where it's disclosed that they are. So what they're doing instead is, of course, using that internally to do other things like censorship or marketing towards their user base. A lot of times that can be welcome from users, and in some cases it's not welcome. So Apple is, in the standpoint of what most people would consider with regard to Google and Facebook, Apple would be left-leaning on the surveillance capitalism spectrum, but still participate in it in with regard to monitoring and recording users' data and usage more than they would need to run a business.
Well, so we're going to come back to that point in a bit, but one of the things that you said when we talked last Thursday that rang very true with me is that, so Purism's line of laptops, and we haven't even actually gotten to what you actually sell yet, but Purism's line of laptops follows the line of trust but verify. Am I getting that right?
That's exactly right, and that's what we discussed last time we spoke. And what you can look at is, so we're the only ones that cross that threshold. And all the corporations that you'd be buying laptops or tablets or any computing device from, even if it comes bundled with software, let's say from Microsoft, but it's an HP computer, or if it's a Google Chromebook, or in the case of Apple, MacBook running OS X, that what you're seeing is all of those corporations are to the right of this bifurcation line, which is that they all have the model of, oh, just trust us, or in the case of Google, do no evil, in the case of Apple, it's just trust us. But they don't ever cross the line into what they should do, which is, of course, allow you to verify that. So that's the trust and verify. So we're the only ones on the left side of that line, which we allow when you purchase a hardware product from us bundled with software where all the source code is free software, where the source code is available, to verify that it operates in your best interest and does not track you.
Now, how would the average person do that? I mean, I totally get how you'd be able to do that. Brian and I would probably be able to do that. But the average person, how would they be able to verify that they're not being tracked?
Right. So that's a fantastic question, because when we say you can verify, what we actually mean is the community or the people can verify. So it doesn't mean that one individual person must go through every single line of code or learn to code to therefore verify that something is not tracking. By releasing the source code out there, then privacy experts and security experts and people whom you trust who go out and review, it allows for third parties, individuals, security experts to actually evaluate that. And then they can say with confidence that the software does not have a backdoor, does not have any tracking code, and then they can also maintain that the next version of something that comes out, that the change log in the new code does not have anything that's tracking. So what that allows for is that it can be verified by third parties, meaning that somebody...
You are essentially crowdsourcing that verification.
Absolutely. The same way that you look to crowdsource your news, right? You go to places that you trust. You don't actually have to go verify every one of the factual claims. What you're doing is you're trusting the journalist who you have started to follow or listen to, or the paper or the publication, to gather up information that you that all is factual based. So it's the same process, right? It is through a community of that it builds this trust, as opposed to simply trusting blindly. So I mean, the counter argument, of course, is in the Apple world, where the software is proprietary, that there isn't anybody who can go in and verify, not a single independent party. So there's not somebody who, I trust you as a security expert, go evaluate Apple to make sure that the software doesn't send any data that I don't want to send back to Apple. And nobody can do that without extreme pain of reverse engineering to monitor packets to see if there's data being sent back. And that ends up resulting, from those security experts who evaluated, that Apple does obviously receive data back. We just don't know what that data is, and we have no way of verifying it. So the trust but verify model allows for where it's not just us saying that we don't track you. You can, the community as a whole, right, hundreds of thousands of people out there who are developers and who evaluate things and security experts, can confirm those claims and fact check those claims.
What do you say to someone like me who says very bluntly, in this case, I actually do trust Apple?
Right. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you like to be enslaved by a corporation and enjoy what they're touting, and they say, trust us, we're not going to do any harm to you, then that's fine. You know, I would say that you're living in ignorance, but that there's nothing wrong with you living in ignorance.
Okay, that's a terrible sales pitch.
Although it gives me an idea for a t-shirt. So, Brian, to go along with mostly pedantic, uh-huh, I'm going to make you another shirt that says mostly ignorant.
I like that, actually.
So you dislike Apple, you dislike Google, right? But the same arguments, barring the third-party ad trackers, can be applied to anybody who's right of that bifurcation line of trust and verify.
Well, actually, another thing that you said to me in our conversation at Pepcom was to follow the money, and okay, which is something, by the way, that Tim Cook has often said.
Absolutely. That's right. And he's right.
So if you follow the money with Apple and you follow the money with Google, you find two different business models.
That's right.
And one of those business models is not only predicated on, but is entirely and always based on making me the product. And the other business model is predicated on making money from hardware.
And subscription services, yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Right. To a lesser extent, the some software services, which really are mostly designed to enhance the value of the hardware. But that's a nitpick that I will certainly accept. And again, what do you say to people who actually trust Apple at their word there?
If you trust a company at their word, then what you have is there's a number of cases where somebody has at least been able to reverse engineer that Apple is tracking, and so as an example, censoring your product, right? So they have control of your product at the end of the day. So whereas, like I said in the beginning, if somebody has a complaint that they say Google's monitoring all my data and sharing it, and I dislike that, that's a completely valid argument. They're the far right wing of surveillance capitalism. But to say that Apple doesn't do any of that is improper, because they do. It's been verified through third party, what we can evaluate from reverse engineering. And then also, but they are more left on surveilling their people, obviously, because they're not doing it as a business practice. They're doing it to improve their product and to have their own marketing team benefit from the data. And then, of course, behind the scenes, we don't know what they're doing with it, right? So in some cases, you obviously heard, right, about, I mean, iCloud hacking, right, where the stuff is available out there and where their Apple will censor apps, they'll censor different services that they run where those things would not have to occur to operate as a business. And so by following the money, you see that Apple is selling hardware and selling services, but they have you have no way to verify their claims of trust them across the board. So if you say you trust Apple from the standpoint of that they are not going to mine your data, then I will concede that they will not mine your data for as many bad purposes as Google and Facebook would. But if you then say that you trust Apple to not censor anything, then obviously you can't say that because they do. So it comes down to what areas do you trust Apple in, and there's no way you can trust them across the board because they are still right of the bifurcation line of trust and verify.
It's true. It is absolutely true. And that was the that was a poignant aspect of our conversation is that. Whether or not one chooses to trust Apple in this case. Now, it's not even a tangent. There's another aspect of that. I argued with you before that most people have proven they don't even care, right? They don't care that Apple is or that Google is rifling through their email, reading it to. Be able to get information about you so they can sell it to advertising.
I'll put a little asterisk next to that, but I agree that they don't care, but there's a subpart to that. Most people who use a free service understand that they are a product to some degree, and it might be subconscious in most cases. It's actually something conscious. They're realizing I'm signing up for a service, but what it provides me inconvenience is more than what I feel as though it is stripping from me in my digital rights. And so that's really what, so again, this is where we get to more of a philosophical debate, which is given an option between a Google, let's just use a mail service, right? So sure. Google web mail service, where you know you sign up, and it is going to be monitoring your data, serving you ads, doing all sorts of things with your third-party data, tracking everything you're doing, et cetera, or a web mail service that's equivalent, but it protects your privacy and respects all your digital rights. Given those two on an even playing field, meaning all other things being equal, users would avoid Google Gmail and go to the privacy-respecting alternative, if all other things being equal, meaning it's just as convenient, just as
and just as free,
prolific, and just as free.
Mm-hmm. So, who's paying for it? See, but that's the thing. You say that most people are aware. I'm not saying that that's some sort of central premise to your existence. You just mentioned that most people are sort of aware that they become the product. Actually, I don't think that most people have. The vast majority of people have put that together. We in the echo chamber talk about that, but outside the echo chamber, people don't even think about this stuff.
I think most people. Go ahead, Todd.
So I want to be clear about that is that if given the option, meaning that on a level playing field, all things being equal, except knowing that you sign up for a service and you're going to be monitored because ads are going to be served to you versus one that is not, that and this comes not just from me being in a ivory tower considering these things. This is actually right from people who have approached us and said, hey, these are the things that are concerned, and then on top of that, within the last couple of years, with more and more people being made aware that there is surveillance going on, that it has risen to a higher level. And then we also have where the reason that we exist as a company, we survive because of people being aware of this, right? So we're getting growing in more and more numbers of that. So if you want to quibble over the majority or the minority, there's a tremendous number of people who use services such as Google and Facebook who are dissatisfied with what is being done with them and their data. But there's no alternative that is as convenient where they would jump ship yet. And of course, the reason is simply is that those are huge money-making machines from an advertising standpoint. So to have an alternative is as a business model shift that we'd have to come up with something that has a service that is equal on all levels except respect to privacy and freedom, which brings us back to your main point, which is that service would have to be free. Mm-hmm. And this is where we get into a nice what our business model is all about. So if you look at Apple, Apple has hardware products that they sell, and then, of course, they can bundle their software for, quote-unquote, free. So with us, and what I've looked at by being a free software supporter for decades, is the problems with free software. There's a number of them, one of which is marketing power, and the other is mass adoption. In some cases, free software dominates. They get more adoption than anything else, like by orders of magnitude. But those are things that aren't usually customer-facing, meaning a user actually using some app, besides some exceptions like, let's say, Firefox. So what we have to have is a model where people will still be willing to pay money for something, which all free software supporters pay money for hardware, because hardware is a physical good that they need to purchase. And then we can reinvest those dollars to improve free software in the areas that it needs. So this, to answer your question in a roundabout way of what could be an alternative to, let's say, a Google, because you wouldn't want to pay for it, service, would be where you have a service that you're paying for only your storage, which everybody pays for storage. And so, and instead, what you're getting with that is a fully encrypted communication stack that you own. You own the entire aspect of it, all the software that runs on it, all the code that runs on it, and it's fully encrypted with your specific keys. That can end up being bundled together with any hosting provider, or it can end up being offered with a service of purchasing hardware from us, and then you end up getting a full encryption stack for communication. So those are a couple of ways in which you can have a business model that actually can compete with the giants that are out there today. So, and really, if you look at it, and I'll turn it back over to some more questions here, is that Apple has a model which is, right, it's all about buying the hardware, getting the software together with it. They make the majority of their money from the selling of the hardware, and then they can use the margin, right, because we're talking about it not a race to the bottom with Apple products, and they can use that margin to invest it in other services to make the product itself a very easy to use across multiple devices platform. That same business model is the exact same business model we have, but we add a very important piece, which is that at the end of the day, users should have their rights protected, and we on our products do that.
All right, we're going to come back to data and data collection and privacy. We're going to come back to that because I've got an aspect of that that you and I haven't talked about, and that I think is extremely interesting. But before we do that, let's take this moment to actually talk about your hardware, because
we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, we haven't actually done that yet. You're selling laptops, and you're actually charging money for it. I'm assuming you actually have some gross margins to play with there.
Right. So we are small, obviously. We started out with a crowdfunding campaign to fund a 15-inch laptop model. The entire business model itself is unique in the free software world, which is that what we're doing is we're actually manufacturing the hardware, so sourcing component parts, manufacturing the motherboard, assembling them, loading completely free software, which is our own distribution, but it's based off of Debian GNU Linux.
It's called Pure OS.
And we load up. It's called Pure OS.
Okay.
We bundle the Purism, Librem laptops or tablets together with Pure OS, and we charge for the hardware. So we ran that campaign, the 15-inch campaign, and then we've run a 13-inch campaign as well. We've shipped both of those products and are continuing to ship and sell those products. And then we just recently, obviously, met at the conference where we were announcing a new 2-in-1 tablet laptop called the Librem 11, where we do the same thing, right? We are manufacturing the motherboard, sourcing the component parts, assembling them, and shipping them out. But we do have the same Apple model, which is we charge where we have margin enough that we can invest to have developers develop the software for free.
And you're using high-quality components, and you've put time and attention into, you know, quaint concepts like form factor and size and weight and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And, so again, since your audience will clearly understand the, you know, making sexy products angle. So yes, we use aluminum CNC machined. We do anodize our aluminum, and then and use highest grade RAM and component parts. So we are talking about comparable pricing to Apple products for free software based goals.
Are you are you actually manufacturing these yourselves? Like, is that being done here in California?
Yeah, it's being done in South San Francisco. And yes, we are assembling it ourselves. So we manufacture. So let's just back up and kind of make it kind of clear. So we source a bunch of parts from all over the world. Then we manufacture the motherboard because we actually add physical hardware kill switches that sever the webcam and microphone.
Sounds like someone's building something right now.
Yeah, apparently that secret microphone I dropped in your warehouse, it just turned on.
Yeah, that's right. So so then we can, and then what we do is we ship all that to South San Francisco, and then we assemble it to order and ship out from there.
I honestly hadn't even asked you about this because I just assumed you were outsourcing all the manufacturing to China like everybody else.
Well, the manufacturing is done in China, so manufacturing of the motherboard. Assembly, which is taking the component parts and assembling them, is done in South San Francisco. So it's just, I want to make sure the terminology is clear. There's a difference between manufacturing and assembly. So we do the manufacturing out of Dongguan, China, and then we source component parts from China as well as a number of other countries, depending on, you know, RAM versus the solid-state drives. So we source those from the companies that provide it. So Samsung is an example for our solid-state drives. And then we bring all those component parts to South San Francisco, and then we inspect them and assemble them, load the operating system, and ship out to the customers from there.
I'd love to tour your facility sometime. I don't know if that's even possible. But,
No, we've done that a couple other times, and we'd be happy to.
Great. All right. So one of the things that you have on your your laptops that you just mentioned is hardware kill switches, and that would be a hardware kill switch for, am I correct here, for the microphone, for the camera, and for the Wi-Fi card?
Yeah. So the microphone and camera are combined into one switch. Since most of the time when you're talking about communication, you're going to want it on or off. And so, you know, 98% of the time, of course, these devices are switched off. And the few times you actually use your microphone or camera, then you can turn them on to operate. And this just really removes at the hardware level, right? So this kind of gets down to another potential tangent, which is really from a security standpoint or freedom standpoint, or even a privacy standpoint. The question really is, how deep does somebody go in protecting that? And so someone can say that, hey, trust us, right? The webcam can't be hacked because we have a circuit between the LED and the webcam. But the issue is that those things are controlled. At some point, they're either controlled in software, at the operating system level, at the or potentially at the BIOS level. And what we've done from user feedback, so when we initially launched the campaign, a bunch of users were actually wanting to help design the Librem 15 and then, of course, the subsequent products. So one of the things that came up during that was that, you know, hey, if we can, we want to sever the actual physical connection to the webcam and microphone, because then there's no software whatsoever that can break in because it's simply not visible even as a device and has no power. Mm-hmm. So those are just a couple things that we have added based off of user feedback to the manufacturing process. So we still are very much listening to what people want out in the marketplace and adjusting as long as it conforms with our philosophies.
All right, that all makes sense, and I don't know of any other laptops that are doing that sort of thing. Period. I mean,
that's something that we know is very unique to us from a hardware kill switch standpoint, and that's going to dovetail into when we actually get to the point of manufacturing a phone, and this kind of relates to how deep do you go standpoint from a privacy and security aspect, where again the trust but verify is one piece, but then you also need to know how much are you verifying and how deep are you verifying. So as an example of a trust us, and then when you start to verify, you scratch the surface and you realize that there's really not much there, would be a lot of the phones that are out there today that say that they're privacy-based phones, is that they say that they make a claim, and then when you scratch the surface, you say, okay, but it's running Android, right? So if it's running Android and you just have an encrypted phone calling app on top of it, that it doesn't go very deep in protecting your privacy, right? So they can make a claim that it is a privacy-based phone, but the depth of it is actually rather shallow. So that's where, when we're actually looking to, and for us going into it, was we wanted to start with a laptop because it was easier for us to prove the business model. And then we can grow from there to the tablet, which a lot of people are familiar with Wi-Fi-based tablets and not necessarily connected to cellular-based tablets. And then we can finally move to phone, which is a little bit harder of a nut to crack to actually create a phone that we can legitimately claim does not track you.
Do you have any thoughts on the black phone?
Well, that's what I was hinting at, obviously, is the black phone, where you scratch the surface and you realize that that it's just encryption at the highest level and is very shallow on its actual claims. So it can't protect you from the majority of threats that are out there, and instead it claims to protect you really from one.
Fair enough. I love your cynicism. I don't normally love cynicism. I love your cynicism.
What I do is I give a little bit and then I take most of it back.
Now, Jeff is muted because he has construction. We actually, so you may not have heard it on your cell phone connection, we heard drills going. And it turns out he has construction, and I assumed that was someone in your office there that was actually doing some machining or something. So he is muted right now, so that we can't hear that. But I guarantee you that he would be laughing. He is laughing right now. So, what phone do you use?
So I use an Android-based phone because we don't have a phone yet. So
I use Android than iOS from a privacy standpoint?
Yes, and the reason actually is because I can install apps on my own. I can run free software running on an Android through Replicant, and the run free software running through F-Droid. So I have options, whereas, granted, they're not ideal options. But
you have the option of whether or not to cut off your nose to spite your face, or to cut off your ear to spite your face, or maybe to gouge your own eyes out to spite your face.
Yeah, except I would say that that's what you're doing on your side. So what I can do on my side is I, of course, don't have to use a phone, right? I mean, that is something that, however, in this case, even for this phone call, where it was initially, right, a Skype phone call, which, right. Of course, I did find amusing since you
I'm with don't you. Use I will not defend right? that. We do record with Skype.
And then, right. And then, but at that point it was, you know, or make a phone call. So I am using, an Android based phone to make this call. However, that's only because, the alternatives for me are to not use a phone or, and I need to wait until we actually put out a legitimate privacy respecting phone. At that point, then I would use that. So those are my options right now. And that's what I use.
I wonder what kind of traction you can get with a phone. It wouldn't surprise me at all if you found greater opportunities from a commercial standpoint with a privacy respecting smartphone than with a laptop. Could be wrong on that.
There's no doubt that we will find greater traction. I mean, we obviously have. You know, a growing amount of traction with regards to laptops and even our tablet. But the phone is, whenever I talk at any conference or anything like that, we as soon as I mention that we're putting out a phone, it's like, sign me up. So, and the reason is because, right, the phone is much more personal device, right? I mean, obviously you're carrying around with you everywhere. And people know that as they're walking around, I mean, all the people that we talk with, they know that they're just leaking data like a, you know, boat wake behind them everywhere they're going. And there's no alternative. And so, and then not only that, but with laptops, right, you at least have the option to install software that you want, right? So I could go and install software that is not approved by the parent company. So whereas tablets and phones, right, in the world of iOS, I can only install an app that has had the blessing of Apple. I have no other options. So that's where people want to have the control. They want to have the understanding that they are not being tracked and have a device that actually respects that. So I know it will be more successful.
Yeah, we're going to end up running out of time. We're like 35 minutes into this, and I know we're going to end up running out of time. So let me interrupt with a question. Cell phone tower tracking is beyond your ken, right? It's not something you're going to have any control over. So
you mean triangulation, right? So there's actually a couple of options. I'll kind of spell them out there for you, and then you can obviously see some cases people who want to give up a lot of the convenience can be completely off the grid, all the way to other ones who are willing to accept triangulation. So obviously GPS is one area where you can pinpoint accurately. But if you're talking about cell towers, then of course you have triangulation where you can still generally get an idea. A lot of people will be fine with just triangulation because it's similar to what they had with their, you know, landline phones, right? It said, okay, I know your location when you're making a call. But if you want to go to the extreme, then obviously whenever you're dealing with, you can end up having it turn off your cell phone, turn off the cell connection, right, the actual band that the cell connects to, and then use wireless only. In that case, then you're off the cell grid, but you can still make phone calls. And what this gets down to is, of course, using VoIP services as opposed to carrier-backed voice services.
But even there,
Go
ahead, finish your thought. Sorry.
So if you're talking about the degrees, let's say there's really, I think there's about 4 degrees that we've at least researched. One is, of course, what all phones have today, which is still always on, unless you turn it into airplane mode. And then in that case, you get triangulation as well as GPS. Then you have the next level over, which is no GPS self-tracking. And then you have a third level in, which is actually where you can leverage the pager network and not have GPS yourself at all. And then when you receive an inbound call, it can enable those. So it's kind of a push model. And then you can have it where it's completely off and you are dealing with wireless only. In the case of wireless only, then it's VoIP activated and you're not using any cellular, you're using wireless connection. And then therefore there's no GPS nor triangulation whatsoever for the device.
But even there, you're still subject to metadata. I know that you know that, of course, but I mean, you're still subject to metadata that's attached to, if it's a VoIP call, that's attached to the packets that are going back and forth. If you are making a cell network call, there's metadata that the cell phone companies have attached to your traffic. So we can't really get away from all tracking.
That's not true. So obviously, if you're using a service that has metadata, meaning if you're making a call from a phone number, then yes, of course. But if you're talking about encrypted voice services, in which there's a number of them out there, then that's not true, right? That is, then you're talking about having a fully distributed voice service to make fully encrypted calls from one peer to another peer, where all packets are fully encrypted between those two nodes. And that, of course, is, again, we're talking really towards an edge case, meaning the people who don't want any tracking whatsoever, period. Those people would be able to use our phone in a wireless mode, Wi-Fi mode, and then use the completely free software with distributed communication to have a point-to-point call encrypted where there is no metadata nor any tracking.
All right. I stand pleasantly corrected on that. All right. So now we need to shift.
It's the same thing you can do with your laptop, right? If you're using, let's say, the Talk service, PoX service, or Ring, or a number of other fully encrypted services. So by using your wireless connection from your phone, no cellular, no GPS, wireless connection from your phone, then you can end up using free software to make that same call. Because really, at the end of the day, and our whole philosophy is surrounding that, all the devices out there are really just computers. So what we should do is have a platform that works on your 15-inch laptop the same as it does your 7-inch phone. And by doing that, then we can have complete privacy protection all the way down to that device.
Yeah, God save me from 7-inch phones, but that's a totally different topic. If you can tell us in brief, who are your customers? Like, who is interested in the Librem line?
So it actually started where we knew going into it that initially it was going to be developers, right? Software developers who understand really our message. But then we wanted to form the beachhead there and expand out, which we're starting to do, which are really people concerned about them being tracked. So people who are already aware of privacy concerns, people who want to bail from Google's services and move on to something else. So we're expanding beyond that to anybody who has a threat model that they're trying to avoid, mostly around the surveillance capitalism and trying to avoid that.
How about spies? How many spies do you have as customers?
Yeah, obviously I wouldn't be able to answer that.
All right, good question. Good answer.
Yeah, that's right, Brian. If Todd answers that, he has to kill us.
Oh, that would be bad. That would be bad. All right, so now we get to the topic that I think is really interesting. So 2 minutes before I first dialed you, I pushed a piece, so I know you haven't read it. And it deals with let me just cut to the chase. Google Now. Are you familiar with Google Now?
Yes.
So
I'll say yes tentatively.
Okay, Google Now is a service that Google offers. Now, I have this incredibly inappropriate joke. I know that Jeff has heard it. and I cannot, this is a family friendly show, so I can't actually say it here, but the polite version is that Google now is Google finally offering something to us for all the plundering of our lives that they've been doing for more than a decade.
Yes, right. I mean, it's so my understanding is it's basically their attempt at Siri.
No, it's actually it's way above what Siri does. Actually, proactive, Apple's proactive on iOS, which was introduced in iOS 9, is Apple's attempt to match Google Now, for whatever that's worth. And it falls short, and that's what we're going to talk about. But Google Now is Google preemptively offering you information that Google thinks that you need or want based on all the, again, the plundering of our lives that they do. So, for instance, I have a very close friend who is an Android user, and he told me about how he had been offered tour data on a band that he had did a Google search on 6 months before. So he does a search on this band, and then 6 months later, without him asking for it, Google Now says, by the way, this band is going to be in San Francisco on this date. Right. That's super useful. Dude, would you agree with that?
If that person wanted that information.
Don't qualify like that. That is a useful service. Whether or not you're willing to pay the price to get that service is a completely separate issue. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that if you're opting in, then it's perfectly fine.
Right.
If you're just wholesale monitoring and then you're surfacing it later, no, that's not fine. And so some people will say, "Oh, hey, that was convenient." Let me provide that same person who says, "Wow, that was convenient," will then be creeped out when something happens and right their device automatically is purchased that band's album and charge their card.
Are talking about the price. I'm not talking about the price for the service. I'm talking about the service itself. And that's just one of the tiny little things that Google Now does. So Google was the first to, it sees an itinerary coming back from an airline in your email. So Google Now will start offering you weather reports for that city in advance of you asking, shortly before your trip, and not long before your trip. There's all kinds of things that Google has been snooping on, and then says, "Hey, right. You know, you might actually find this interesting." And many of those things are extremely useful and helpful. It's machine learning being used for our benefit. And here's the thing. All right, so I actually find that idea incredibly compelling. And the thing is that the machines or the corporations in this case have to know this stuff about us to be able to sift through this information and present these things that may be useful to us.
Brian, the idea that I like is something like Google Now, where it can anticipate what we want, give us the traffic alerts ahead of time, give us the weather for the city we're traveling to, all that kind of stuff. But then to have it siloed so that all this personal information about me is stored in a secure way that I control.
Well, that's what I want too. But from Todd's perspective, and again, this is something that Todd and I did not talk about ahead of time, that wouldn't be acceptable because Todd doesn't want that information to be collected, period. And that's what I wanted to gauge your thoughts on, Todd.
So there's one piece I'm going to add there. Obviously, if I publish something and I want it to be public, then that is public information that can be used. And that's the whole point of, right? So it's not by saying you want to have something private that you're saying that all things that I have want to be private. I have no problem with somebody wanting to publish something and making it, putting it in public domain. If they, you know, and saying, hey, this is free for all to use and evaluate, and this is what I stand for. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. That data, of course, can be used and monitored and mined. And then you can end up creating a lot of very, very cool services. The issue ends up being really around if I opt in for a service, and I know what I'm getting with that service, there are a number of ways to actually do things ethically where you can still provide the tremendous benefit of predicting, you know, saying, hey, you're going to be traveling, and provide you the weather of where you're going to be traveling without having Google, or a large corporation, know that plus all the other mapped data to your life. And so that would be an example where you can even have an app that can join together your travel plans since you booked them and with the destination and just simply surface to you the weather patterns. So in every one of the cases, there's an ethical approach to taking to it. And the main problem with companies that are looking at this is they don't care about the ethical aspect of it. They just want more data, and the more data, then the more valuable their piece is, as opposed to looking at a way to have you protect your data that you want and yet share certain amounts of data that you want public that they can, of course, provide services around.
I'm with you on I'm with you like on probably what I don't know 80 to 90% of all the things that you talk about and have written extensively about them and spoken extensively about them. In this particular case, though, there is no substitute for the machine slurping up everything and sifting through it and figuring out what's useful to us. There is no way to come even close to that the potential that system offers by hand selecting, hand curating the information ourselves that we feed into the machine. Right.
Yeah, I understand what your point is, which your point, I will restate and then answer, is that you're saying that you need wholesale access to all data to be able to curate and provide specific information for an individual because you can base it off of machine learning. And this is where I believe that there's an ethical approach to doing that. Is first of all, you can have data that is ethically slurped up, as you're calling it, to be able to determine what people are interested in and where they're going and what they're traveling, right, all the different locations and having all the weather. And then based off of that, you can provide the algorithms to encrypted services that says my app that I'm going to be launching, or let's say a push service to my phone, that can alert me. But it's alerting me based off of my data to an encrypted algorithm in my encrypted world, my walled garden of encrypted world, to where Google doesn't know that it has sent me that data because it doesn't need to know that it sent me that data. It provided the algorithm based off of all the information that I have shared or kept in my own walled garden. So that ends up being an ethical approach to taking where you can have the convenience of learning information that's relevant to you without having to have a corporation slurp up 100% of everything that you have that you wanted to keep private.
Yeah, but I don't think you can get that algorithm without again slurping up not only everything from you but everything from everybody else too, so that you can actually figure out the relationships. I mean, that's the whole idea behind big data to begin with, and what can be learned from big data, and the kinds of useful things that big data can provide back to us, the humans.
Right. So let me try and make it as simple as possible. Is that if an ethical approach were taken where it was anonymized data, then you get all the benefits of machine learning without exploiting an individual. And then you can end up applying that to an individual's
okay, yeah, fair, yeah, no, I get that.
With right. an encrypted and, manner. So
And if that can happen, that would be great. And the question is, who would then have the incentive to develop it? Because right. it's going to cost money to make that happen.
That's right. So the big issue would be if. So to solve that is obviously something our business is not focusing on today. But okay, to solve that, it would take a business model that actually can benefit from the either selling of the algorithm or of the data mining, where you're saying, here's all this anonymous data, and we're willing to, users are willing to provide that data in an anonymous fashion. And then you can leverage that against individual apps that can work within the encrypted space of that user. The main issue is that, three or so years ago, really a very minority, only the privacy advocates out there were really pushing towards trying to look towards anonymity of data. And now it's at least a topic of discussion that's growing, even though it's still small. But that's an area that I can see becoming a greater topic of conversation, over the course of the next 5 years.
You were assuredly right there. And I'm going to sort of be a little unfair, because I'm going to leave this part of the conversation with the thought that this is an area where Apple doesn't go far enough. Apple is theoretically committed to our privacy. Again, you have to trust and can't verify that. But Apple says it's committed to our privacy. But Apple has further stated, Apple CEO Tim Cook has specifically stated that he doesn't feel like, say, Apple News needs to know what song we're listening to. And I completely disagree there. I actually want Apple to collect this data. I just want Apple to not sell it. I want Apple to collect this data so that it can actually provide me with useful information. Now, that said, we are just about out of time. I will add that you probably can't hear it in his voice, but Todd Weaver is a smiling man. This man smiles. There's a photograph of him on the About page on the Purism's corporate site. And it captures his smile. This is a man who believes in what he's doing, and I'm super fascinated by your company. I don't intend to become a customer, but I wish you massive success, because I think that you could possibly help change the conversation far beyond just your company, while at the same time making some money doing so.
Excellent. Well, I certainly appreciate being on the call, and would welcome discussing anything in the future that you guys have come up. I really appreciate talking to people who can think pragmatically about these problems, and this discussion is educating me as well as I hope it educated you.
Oh man, absolutely. I've learned a ton.
Oh yes.
This is so important to me. This idea of surveillance capitalism is just so incredibly important, and I'm sure that we will continue to have conversations in the future. But we are out of time today.
Yes, we are. I hate to wrap up, especially because I had to be so quiet since I couldn't get the interns to put the saws down. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And thanks for listening.
So our special guest this week has been Todd Weaver, founder and CEO of Purism. That's PURI.SM is where their site is. We'll have links in the show notes. We very much appreciate your time today, Todd.
I appreciate it as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here.
Now,
you're trying to talk, Brian. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that aside from Todd's comments, our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth's provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week, except for Jeff's going to say something.
That's right. I'm going to say that you need to stay subscribed.
That's it? You're not going to say something else, too?
No, I'm just going to leave it at that.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.